So, hi, Molly.
Hi, Dan.
What are we talking about today? Let's just start off with that.
Well, today we're going to talk about competition and antitrust, particularly in technology markets.
So this is a huge kettle of fish, and I'm worried about delving into it, not being a lawyer. But we have some great experts lined up that we have spent the last month or so talking to about this. So hopefully we won't be flying too blind. So when we're talking about competition in the tech marketplace, what are we thinking about?
Well, the big case has been the Microsoft case, which was centered around how Microsoft dealt with internet browsers bundled with their operating system. And we actually have someone who was one of the counsels on that case who's going to tell us a little bit about it.
That's right. His name is Phil Malone, and he is the director of the Cyber Law Clinic here at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And he's probably one of the people who knows the most about this case. So let's just let him give a little bit of background.
Netscape introduced its first graphical user interface browser in 1995. And at that point, Microsoft was really well positioned, had a very strong monopoly in Windows, and they saw the existence of an independent browser, and especially an independent browser in Java, working together as a real threat to their operating system. And so at that point, and they had also been a bit slow to recognize the importance of the internet, how the internet was going to change everything in terms of computing and how and where people interacted with information. And so it was that that development, really, the development of the internet and then of consumer-friendly browsers that were going to be used, you know, by the great mass of people in the public, that really frightened them and spurred them to take a bunch of steps to try to stop it and make sure that didn't happen before the browser war started.
Browser wars.
Yeah, that sounds really dramatic. can you parse a little bit of that out for me, maybe? What was the objective of the investigation?
Well, one of the big problems with Microsoft was this practice of bundling, which is they shipped Internet Explorer with the Microsoft operating system and put the IE icon really prominently on the desktop. And most users, when they saw this, they said, I do not need to get another web browser. I have a web browser, and it is called Internet Explorer, and it will be my web browser. And so in that way, Microsoft pushed a lot of the other up-and-coming web browsers like Netscape Navigator completely out of the market just by, you know, sort of implicitly guiding users in one direction or another because they already had them in their system, literally in their operating system.
This sounds absurd to me, looking back from the year 2010, that simply by the act of including a piece of software on somebody's new computer, you could be accused of anti-competitive technology. I mean, I'm just thinking about the new Apple laptop that I just got. It came with a full suite of programs. I've got iMovie. I've got Safari, which is their version of Internet Explorer, their own web browser. And where are the regulators coming to say that's not allowed?
Well, a lot of it has to do with market share. So Apple does come with a lot of bundled software, but it only has 6.4% market share. So no one is really concerned about what they do with their little less than 10% of the market because they can't affect a large number of people. Another thing about the Microsoft case was you couldn't actually uninstall IE without taking a chunk of the operating system with you. So there was no way to get rid of it. You can uninstall Safari, and it won't hurt anything. You can put on Firefox, you can put on, you know, Opera, you can put on IE if you want, if you really, really wanted. And it won't hurt anything. But if you attach this peripheral in such a way that you'll rip the heart out of the computer if you take it out, then you're actually starting to dictate user behavior.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we're dealing with two things there. But one is the intent that Microsoft, we could say, they intentionally came in and said, we're going to discourage you from using anything that could possibly compete with a component of our Windows operating system. But the more important thing here is that Microsoft had a huge chunk of eyeballs of people who were buying PCs. So it's kind of like, it sounds like to me like a punishment for success. You know, like if I somehow manage to get a huge number of people who love my product, then the regulators are going to come in and say, you know, scrutinize my practices.
Punishment for success is a might be a little loaded. It's more, congratulations, you sold a lot of units. You now don't get to step on people's faces.
Well, let's talk about, is there another company around right now that might be a better analog than Apple? Is there something that's more similar to Microsoft?
Well, one company that people keep talking about is Google. And Google does this thing where it hooks up a lot of its services into, like, you have Gmail that's hooked up to Google Talk, which is now apparently hooked up to Google Voice, which is hooked up to Google Maps. So if you say, like, I am invited to a party at Green Street, it will say, I would like to put this into your calendar. I would also like to tell you where it is, using this suite of Google services that I've integrated together.
Okay, so you spoke to somebody who has actually been doing some research on Google and bundling.
Yeah, I talked to Gary Reback, who also worked on the Microsoft case and has done a lot of work recently about Google and the ways in which it may be engaged in some not nice business practices.
So one of the things that Microsoft got in trouble for was bundling. Now, what Google is doing, just as an example, is starting in 2007, although nobody understood the consequence of it, but starting in 2007 and more recently, what they have done is they have bundled, or to use their word, they have blended into their general search. The general search, you know, Google.com has, what, a 75% share in the United States, 95% share in Europe and worldwide. They have blended Maps into that, for example, and they have blended blog search into that, for example, and they threaten to do that with everything, with books, with finance. So the notion is that they're using their dominance in the platform. Their platform in this case is horizontal search, to extend that dominance into new partial substitutes. But the point is that they're using their power in one market to both leverage into the next market and to maintain the monopoly in the existing markets, because they're eliminating partial substitutes. Google is doing exactly what Microsoft did. And what ought to we do about that? Should we start the debate all over again as to whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, which is what Google would like us to do? Or should we learn from what happened in the Microsoft situation and how the conduct was held illegal by the courts and start there?
So what is he saying there?
Basically, what Gary is saying is that Google is using a lot of disparate services like Gmail or Google Maps or Blogger or YouTube, and tying them together into this sort of net that catches customers and keeps them from going to other services. So not only does it sort of glean from around the net a lot of information that it uses to augment search, but it also uses that information and this net of services to throw their own services back at the customer. So, oh, you want a video? Don't look at Vimeo. YouTube! Or, you want to go somewhere? We've never heard of MapQuest. Here, have Google Maps.
That sounds like it's a big worry, but Google's motto also is, we're not evil, right? So, you know, why would Google, one of the biggest proponents of the open web ever, want to, you know, create their own little walled garden?
Well, in a lot of ways, Google benefits from the open web, in that it takes a lot of the information that is generated through the open web and through sort of the open source free culture philosophy, and then pulls that into search, and then uses that to serve things to you that you want, which makes you hang out more, which makes you give them more of your information, which gives them more of your information, which they can do God knows what with.
And so that gets into what is Google's, maybe used to be considered Google's core business, maybe still is, but search. And a lot of people are talking right now about what's called search neutrality. So what is search neutrality, and why should we be worried?
There's a couple of things to remember about search neutrality.
Okay, so wait, who's that?
That's Siva Vaidyanathan, who's a professor at the University of Virginia Law School, and he's actually done a lot of work on Google recently. He has a book coming out called The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Be Worried.
It is oxymoronic. One cannot have a neutral search engine. The very act of searching is the act of discrimination. The question, I think, is more importantly one of transparency. Now, for a company like Google to be forced into any level of transparency is to essentially give up the game, right? Give up the competitive advantage. At the same time, let's think about this in terms of Republican values. It's really important as search engines, especially Google, become our first stop in searching about the world, become the lens through which we see the world. It's increasingly important to remember that the biases of Google are baked into the algorithms, and we should have some sense of it.
So Siva doesn't seem to have like a clear answer on regulation of search, but it brings in this question of how would you regulate search and why? I mean, what is it we use search for? It seems like a really esoteric kind of question that you need to answer before you get in any question of putting together a tribunal to like look at this.
Well, what is the purpose of search? Why do you search for something?
I search when I want to find a place to eat dinner at night, for instance. I do that a lot.
So say you want to find a pizza restaurant in Harvard Square that is vegetarian friendly and is open after 11.
Well, I'll just type in pizza to Google. And usually, like, without a doubt, I'll see like a map will pop up and it'll say pizza within my, 5 mile radius. How does it know that?
So Google is taking all of this information that it already has about you from your search history, from your emails, from your chat logs, and it's using it to build this dossier on things that you like, things that Dan likes. And thus, it's more able to target ads specifically to you and to figure out what you want when you want to search for something. So what else is it doing with all that information?
That's a good question, actually. I'm of two minds on that. Maybe you can help me parse this out, because what you've just described to me makes me very uncomfortable on one hand, but it also makes me very glad. I mean, I'm saving valuable seconds. I have pizza, that's when I have that, I'm happy. So is that why we should be regulating? Is it it's the question of what else they're doing with my information?
Well, that is one of the questions. One of the other questions is, why didn't they show you MapQuest? Why didn't they show you Yelp? Why did they direct you directly to Google Maps?
Why should a regulator be concerned?
Well, how do you know you're getting what you want? You just know that you have gotten what you have gotten. You asked for pizza, you got a map, it had little pizza places on it. And if you go to one of these things, and it in fact is a pizza restaurant, and you are not served Chinese food or a burger that you didn't want, then excellent, Google gave you a result that gave you pizza. But what if there is a better result somewhere? Or what if there is just a different result somewhere?
It sounds like this is getting back into those kinds of principles that regulators wanted to enforce during the Microsoft case, that customers were getting something and they may or may not have been happy with it, but it's creating an issue for a competitive marketplace to determine whether a consumer is able to get what they want.
Yeah, there's a question of when you have your consumer in your box, in your walled garden, and Google is far from being a walled garden at this point, but there are certain people who are making that argument. Once you have your customer there, are you the only person who's allowed to talk to them? So basically what Siva was saying is that Google has gone from being what was essentially a business, and it operated like a business, and we had the expectations of it, of a business, and it's moved into being this internet utility. It's the door you go through when you go to the internet. It's the glasses you put on when you want to find something. And there are things about that door, and there are things about those glasses that we don't understand, but they affect the way we enter and see that world. And that should be examined. But we're not necessarily at the point where we need to, bring in the big federal guns and try to break things up, or even necessarily, do a real investigation, but things should be examined. And we should not just blindly trust Google because it has a really clean interface.
So no FTC SWAT teams busting in the Google doors right just yet?
Not to the Googleplex, not just now.
Okay, good. Well, it's good to know. we were talking about walled gardens earlier. I think this a company that people are speculating might have FTC busting down their door sooner is Apple. We talk about how Apple has been developing software to sell hardware. The iPhone is something of a walled garden that has been increasingly swallowing up market share and could be headed towards monopoly status at some point. So I spoke to a guy named Brian Chen, who's writing a book on the experience of Apple, and he also works for Wired, and he had a few things to say about Apple strategy.
If you look at the iPhone, the whole thing is about a tightly controlled experience, and because they have that sort of package they want to sell, they lock down the experience, so then they only allow their software to run on Apple hardware.
Is anti-competitive the way you would characterize Apple's behavior?
No, I wouldn't characterize them as being anti-competitive. I would characterize them as being protective of their intellectual property. And a lot of times they come off as being anti-competitive, but you got to look at the history of Apple. You know, back in, I think it was the 80s when Steve Jobs got, you know, booted, and, you know, new people took over and they started licensing Macintosh clones. They allowed other companies to put the Mac software onto, you know, just generic PCs. The company almost tanked, and Apple was almost bankrupt. And you know, when Steve Jobs came back, he got rid of the clone program, and that was a reaction to things just not working that way. And this has been their long-term strategy for years now. They want to protect their own intellectual property for the sake of retaining a premium brand, and it's been working. Very recently, they surpassed Microsoft in market cap, so it's been a successful strategy.
So what's the difference between anti-competitive and protective?
Yeah, that's something that doesn't seem quite clear. I mean, basically, I think the question of the difference between anti-competitiveness and protectiveness is something that the regulators and Apple are navigating as we speak. But Brian also had some things to say about where Apple might see challenges sooner than later.
I think right now what's going on in the mobile ad space is where they might be venturing toward anti-competition. So along with the prohibition of Flash, they also just recently imposed a rule not allowing third-party analytics departments to track user behavior inside iPhone and iPad applications. Well, actually, they allow people to do it, but Apple has to sign off and approve, like, you know, we'll let you guys in here. But the big kicker with that is that they won't allow any major analytics company, and that's Google. They won't allow Google AdMob to do their analytics services to serve advertisements through their iPhone apps. And so at that point, I think, you know, when you're setting yourself up to dominate a market, and that's going to be the mobile ad market, because right now, Apple has such a huge grab of the mobile app space. They have something like 99.5% of the mobile applications served, like downloaded last year, were just from the iPhone. I think that's a particular area where people are going to be paying attention to and should continue to pay attention to for the entire industry's sake. They should be concerned.
Wait. Did he say 99% of the mobile ad space?
That gave me pause too, because he kind of buries the lead there a little bit. The fact that Apple has that much control, I mean, that seems like something we should be worried about, right?
Yeah, this definitely sounds like the textbook definition of a captive market.
That's where we get into some definitional problems, because it depends on what you define as the market. Some people look at the iPhone and see it as part of the smartphone market. But if some savvy regulator came in and said, no, it's an app market, then you would have a lot more of a question, I think. And then who we're concerned about being affected by this is, in the case that Brian was talking about earlier, the ad folks, or down the road, the app developers.
Well, my name is Greg Hughes. I'm 20 years old now when I developed Wi-Fi.
Greg Hughes, actually, he's one of the app developers who's currently being affected by Apple's closed iPhone app development process. So he developed an app called Wi-Fi Sync, which works solely for the iPhone.
Well, it basically allows you to synchronize an iPhone. Rather than use a USB cable, you can just do it without one over a wireless network. So it basically does away with the need for a physical connection.
That sounds really cool. If I had an iPhone, I would totally buy that.
Well, I have an iPhone, and I would totally buy it if I could. It turned out that Apple rejected the app, and Greg found another way.
Yeah, I knew about Cydia because I previously jailbroken my phone.
That Cydia is the platform for dominant platform for jailbreaking.
It's basically the alternative app store for people who've jailbroken their phone with all sorts of goodies and apps that Apple would never allow people to install. The wireless sync aspect, you know, the concept is really interesting to lots and lots of people. And I would say Apple made a mistake in, you know, not accepting onto their store. Or they've also made a mistake in not doing it themselves, as clearly it's a feature that thousands and thousands of iPhone users want to use. You know, Wi-Fi Sync has sold, as of just now, over 17,000 copies. So it really does show that people are willing to jailbreak their phone in order to get something which they perceive as, you know, having some value to them. I'm not going to hold any grudges because it wasn't accepted. And as far as I'm concerned, it was never going to be accepted. So the App Store, to me, it's just something which I was never going to get into anyway with this particular app.
Well, I can imagine that's the very graceful approach, because I can imagine for some app developers that if they can't reach the kind of market that they want to reach, the return on investment wouldn't be, you know, as good as it could be. And therefore, you couldn't put that money back into fueling more apps and building potentially a small business.
Absolutely. Well, you have to remember that if Apple had their way, there wouldn't be a jailbreak. So people who got rejected from the App Store, they would have nowhere to go. So if Apple say no, and you've spent thousands and thousands of dollars developing an app, you'd have wasted your money because there's no way to get it back because you can't sell it. So, you know, it's very, very worrying that they have that kind of power. But that's the way things are at the moment.
So I don't think that Apple always has the best intentions of the developer at heart when it's looking at apps to approve or disapprove. It very often has the best interests of Apple at heart, which is its prerogative, but as it's creating this captive market, which is very large and very lucrative, we have to look at whose concerns need to be paramount here. Do they need to be the concerns of Apple, or do they need to be the potential concerns of the market?
So I think this is something interesting to follow as we as non-lawyers have redefined a new market. We've said that, yes, apps themselves, not just smartphones, are a new market. I'd be excited to, you know, have a lawyer or somebody from a tech company come in and comment on the show and tell us whether that's valid or whether we're completely wrong. But I think it is valid. I personally, and I agree with you, I think that is kind of valid thing, especially as it affects app developers like Greg. So we've gone through a lot of companies that are the dominant companies today. We certainly haven't mentioned all of them. We haven't talked much about Facebook or Amazon. But now that we have identified some cases where there might be a regulatory response, I mean, how do regulators respond with companies that are engaged in anti-competitive behavior? You have a regulator coming in and trying to break them up or issue some sort of remedy for the actions that they've done wrong. How do we know whether a regulator should do something about it and what the effect of that will be on the market?
Well, actually, Phil Malone had something really interesting to say about that.
It's so hard to know what the but-for world would be. So, you know, one big debate in the Microsoft case was, well, if Microsoft hadn't done all of these predatory things, if they had just gone out and competed hard on the merits, would Netscape and Java really have taken off and become an independent platform and undermine Microsoft's operating system? And the answer is there's no way to know, right? It's a sort of counterfactual that we can never test. Part of what's challenging and exciting about antitrust is it's typically called on to make predictive judgments. Mm-hmm. You know, you're asked to try to divine ahead of time what the effect of a merger is going to be on competition that would have occurred but for the merger. Or you're asked to evaluate, you know, what difference these kinds of contracts or this kind of design of a product, what effect has this had? And more importantly, what will it have going forward on the market? And, you know, I think antitrust can do a pretty good job of that, but you can never prove it. You know, you can never sort of watch the video of what would have been otherwise and say, oh, well, okay, so that would have been the alternate world.
Right. So what Phil's saying is there's really no way to know whether or not a regulatory action has any effect. You know, you can try to model these things all you want, but it won't tell you whether or not you made a difference.
This is true. And there are also a lot of different actions that regulators can take. They can actually move in and break up a huge monopoly, like what happened with Ma Bell, or they can just levy huge fines, like what happened to Microsoft, or they can institute a federal regulation commission, like the search commission idea that's getting bandied about a lot now in terms of search regulation, or they can just do nothing.
The way technology companies are different, it seems to me, and this is something I witnessed covering the Microsoft trial, in that the judges...
And that's Ken Aletta. He's a writer. He does a lot of stuff for The New Yorker. He wrote a book about the Microsoft antitrust case, and he knows a lot about technology and technology policy.
My view was that the judge's decision, which was based on the recommendation of the Justice Department at the time, was that you had to break up Microsoft. And my view was that open source... et cetera, was going to break up Microsoft by itself. And that's proven to be true. And in that the world was moving so fast away from the command and control model of Microsoft, and that it would happen naturally. And you didn't have to engineer a bureaucratic solution for something that the marketplace was doing.
He had some very interesting things to say about Amazon, which we unfortunately do not have time for in this podcast, but I direct our listeners to our lovely website where they can access all of our original interviews, as well as some bibliographic material and links and deep links where you can do exploration on your own.
Yes, so we'll have links to all of these interviews up at the site and in the show notes. So make sure you go to blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman, and we'll track that down for you. Okay, so there's lots of different regulatory responses and possible regulatory responses, it sounds like. And I want to go back and emphasize that we are not lawyers. We hope that you'll respond whether or not we're wrong and engage in our forum on the blog.
We should have a warning light. We are not lawyers.
You know what? I think we should have a lawyer in the room on this show and just have them hit a buzzer or a gong every time we say something that we could be getting in trouble for.
And while we may not be lawyers, Lawrence Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain are lawyers, and super lawyers at that.
That's right. We had them here at the Berkman Center in front of a gracious audience of interns in the first of what might hopefully be a regular segment in our podcast series. So this has been Dan Jones
and Molly Sauter.
We'll see you next time.